And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West. The most haunted city in the country. Well, I've been talking about a lot of different topics. And I keep getting emails wanting me to talk about aliens, UFOs, you know, according to the stories, extraterrestrials have been visiting Earth for thousands of years and maybe even longer than that. And from the time of the Second World War, they've been observed in even greater numbers, and the beginnings of a new millennium seen a sharp increase in both sightings of UFOs and reported cases of contact between humans and aliens. You know, the volume of traffic between our world and extraterrestrials is now so immense, we wouldn't be far from wrong if we said there's been an alien invasion. So why are they coming to Earth in such numbers? What do they want? Have they come to harm us or to bring us the wisdom of the stars? Or maybe they got nothing else better to do. Now, there's a lot of theories about why aliens are coming to Earth in such numbers. They may want to destroy the world, exterminate the human race, replace us as the dominant species on Earth, enslave us, steal our natural resources, harvest our crops, seize our animals, and even humans as food. And there are also stories that human brains have been extracted by them as tissue. Now, there are a lot of accounts of humans being kidnapped, subjected to strange and sometimes unusual medical experiments. Abductees have also reported a possible breeding program designed to produce a hybrid species that's half human, half alien. You know, some aliens appear malevolent. Others appear to be messengers from some kind of advanced civilization that's come to bring us their wisdom or help us save the planet. You know, with the threats of war, increasing natural disasters, growing environmental problems, maybe they came to heal the planet and show us the way forward to a new and better future. I will point out, as far back as George Adamski, back in the 50s, aliens have been trying to get us to stop nuclear testing. You know, humans and aliens have also interacted in a variety of different ways. Some aliens appear instantaneously, arriving out of nowhere. Others are observed entering or leaving spaceships. A few are only visible to one or two observers. Others are clearly witnessed by large numbers of people. Now, the number and variety of aliens coming is also surprising. They're often perceived as being humanoid in nature, but also they appear as animals, insects, robots, substances, and even holograms. Sometimes no physical entity is observed, but a process of thought transference takes place. This type of mental interaction often precedes direct contact. You know, contacts between humans and aliens are also made in a number of different ways, which we'll talk about as we go along. And another relevant question is, why is it that on the whole, ordinary people rather than political or military figures report these contacts? Could extraterrestrials consciously avoid authority figures, or is it perhaps that these contacts do take place, but they're immediately classified? Now, from all the different sightings, there are approximately 10 principal types of alien beings that have been reported. Now, these are the main categories. Of course, there are a lot of subcategories. First, there are the humanoids. These are the human type that's indistinguishable from ordinary humans. They're humanoids that seem nearly the same as humans, but they might have subtle differences. There have been flying humanoids, there have been giants, and sometimes children. Then we have the grays. We have small grays, tan grays, officers, even one supreme commander of the Greys, who's almost always described as being a female. Then there's robots. There's metallic robots, flashy robots, slabs. There's been a number of different types reported. How about elementals? Creatures that resemble fairies and elves and dwarves and creatures from mythology and folklore. Then we have the mysterious animals, the big cats, reptiles, sometimes called reptoids by folks they've contacted. Then we have monsters. Then we have, well, for lack of a better term, substances. Then there's been hybrids, the apparent result of alien-human genetic experiments. Then we have the wise, benevolent space brothers. And finally, we have holographic creations. Now, the most common type of alien reported by observers and contactees and abductees and all the other E's out there belong to the humanoid category. And some are entirely indistinguishable from ordinary humans, and that group in particular has generated a great controversy among the ufologists. And although technically the Greys belong to the humanoid class, there are often striking differences in a variety of subforms among them, making it more appropriate to treat them as a separate category. Now, there are a number of theories that have come about the humans. One, they're actual humans assisting the aliens. Two, they're humans engaged in secret government projects, pretending to be aliens. Three, they're the offspring of human extraterrestrial mating. Four, they're humans just having a good time carrying out a hoax. Five, they're non-human entities coming to us in a form that our mind is able to grasp. Now, in Las Cruces, New Mexico, back in 1972, there was a young woman named Hilda McAfee. Now, I was told about this instance a short time ago. I had to do some research. They described seeing two human-looking figures between 5.5 feet and 6 feet tall. The men were wearing blue overalls with matching boots. Faces were covered with helmets, and they were working on some sort of vehicle. Of course, neither Hilda nor her mother, who was with her, was able to give a clear description of the craft they were said to be working on. It appeared to be surrounded by a bright blue light that hid the shape of the object from them. And near the two men were some small black rods. Now, the figures took no notice of the women, and one even had his back turned to them, and by the time their car had driven by, the women looked back and noticed the object had disappeared. The bright light they saw had seemed to have been turned off, and their impression was it had been switched on to avoid a car hitting them. Both women said their bones hurt, their chests ached, and they had suffered burning. Now, there are those that believe this was a secret government experiment that the two women had come up on. Certainly that's a possibility. Now, there have been a lot of reports of humanoid figures similar to ordinary humans, but they seem to have subtle differences, such as greater or lesser number of eyes, the absence of a mouth or ears, or limbs that lack hands or feet. Now, one type of humanoid that's been reported a number of times is a flying humanoid. And reports of these entities date back for thousands of years. The first sighting since the age of the UFO began. Now, even though UFOs have been around for thousands of years, there are those that believe the age of the UFO didn't begin until 1947. With the crash of the UFO at Roswell. But this particular sighting I'm going to talk about took place in January of 1948 when Bernice Zakowski in Chehalis, Washington, was standing outside her barn at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and heard a strange noise coming from straight above her head. Looked up and saw a man flying past with a pair of silver wings attached to his back. She reported he was flying at a height of about 200 feet. Now, what makes this sighting particularly unusual is it was also witnessed by a group of children who had just finished school and were making their way back home. Well, the man saw he had an audience, began performing maneuvers in the sky before put his hand on his chest and touched what appeared to be a button. And he went straight up into the air and disappeared. And, of course, that particular encounter generated a lot of newspaper headlines. In June of 53 in Houston, three neighbors, Howard Phillips, Judy Myers, and Hilda Walker, were sitting on the porch of their apartment block when they saw a huge shadow pass over the lawn. At first, they thought it was a moth caught in the reflection of a nearby street light, but then they saw it stopping in a tree. Well, out of curiosity, they investigated further, and they found a man with wings similar to those of a bat. They said he was about 6 feet, 6 inches tall, wore tight clothes with a cloak or a cape, and appeared to be emitting a peculiar gray light. He remained in full view for about 15 minutes before he began to fade and disappear. The three witnesses said they heard a noise and saw a white object they said was shaped like a rocket vanishing up into the sky. Did Batman, as they referred to him, leave in a rocket? Well, in August of 1969, an interesting thing was seen in Vietnam. There were three soldiers. You know, this is at the height of the Vietnam War. And these three soldiers were serving there when they saw a truly bizarre example of a flying humanoid. It was 1 a.m, and they saw a trace of movement in the skies overhead. As they got closer, they were stunned to see a naked woman with wings like those of a bat. They said her skin was jet black and seemed to be shining with a weird green light. She flew light above their heads, only about 7 feet up. Completely silent till she was about 10 feet away from camp when she began flapping her wings vigorously. And as they stood there in utter bafflement watching, they noticed what there didn't seem to be any bones in the female's arms. Well, of course, what I've heard referred to as the best known flying humanoid is an entity referred to as Owlman. Visited the west country of England, is particularly active in the region of Monaghan and Cornwall. Now, the first reported sighting of this entity occurred in April of 1976. June Melling and her sister Vicky saw a large man hovering over the village church. He was hovering, I say, because they said he had wings. On July 4th and 1976, two teenage girls on a camping holiday heard an unusual noise in the woods. As they looked around, they were surprised to see a figure standing in the trees only about 20 yards away from them. One of them said he resembled a large owl and had bright light eyes that seemed to glow. But the girls thought it was a practical joke until they saw the figure flap his wings and take off and fly away. Next day, another woman saw that creature. She described it as being like a full-grown mammal with legs bent backward like a bird's. When it saw her, it rose up into the sky and flew into the trees. She said it had red eyes, adding it had a large mouth and a body of silver-gray, and it had feathers. She said the legs reminded her of the claws of a crab, and between 77 and 78, there were a number of sightings of what folks were calling Owl Man in the region of Monaghan Church. This is still a mystery to this day. Now, in Indonesia, there have been a number of interesting stories. The island of Suram has a story about a flying humanoid known as an orang body. Local population claims it lives inside the extinct volcanoes on the island. They say it's about 5 feet tall, has red skin, large wings like a bat, and a long tail, but other than that, it has a perfectly normal human appearance. At night, the orang body is said to leave their homes in the volcanoes and venture out to the local houses where from time to time they steal a child and take it back up to the volcanic homes. Then, of course, there have been sightings of giants that go back as far as history does. They're infrequently reported in connection with UFO sightings, although some contactees and a few abductees have spoken of meeting or at least observing them. And then there are the children. What might be referred to as the wise babies and the twill. Wise babies take the form of normal human children, but appear to be exceptionally advanced compared to normal child. It's been suggested that a result of human extraterrestrial mating. The tuyul, like the orange baddies, native to Indonesia, described as a bald, completely naked child with red skin and huge eyes. In all other aspects, it appears to resemble the grays. And one unique aspect of the tuyul is that when it moves, its feet never seem to touch the ground. Well, during the days of George Adamski, it was the Nordics that everyone talked about. But in recent years, the grays have become the most commonly reported type of alien. They've almost become fashionable, and some of the more committed ufologists refuse to accept sightings of any other type of alien as being a genuine report. Well, even within the category of the grays, there are a number of subgroups. Now, the small grays are generally described as standing between 3.5 to 4 feet tall and having gray or grayish-white skin. Extremely pale and have exceptionally thin arms and legs, and some appear to have neither knees nor elbows and tend to have disproportionately big heads. On the whole, they don't have signs of a nose or body hair, and the ears are either missing or extremely small. The mouths are either non-existent or just a tiny slit. The more pronounced feature about the grays is their huge, almond-shaped, coal-black eyes. They've often been compared to worker bees, and their behavior frequently appears robotic and without any actual purpose. Then we have the tan grays, sometimes called the tall grays, that work in tandem with the small grays. They've got a darker color skin and are normally about 5 feet tall. They appear to supervise the various medical tests that are performed on abductees, and some of them have even informed the abductees that they're doctors. Then we have a 6-foot-tall gray that appears to be in charge of the other groups. They vary slightly in terms of their physical description, but there's a general agreement among those that have seen them. They're taller than the other grays, and they appear to make the decisions. Sometimes they're described as being more similar to humans in their physical development than the other types of grays. They certainly appear to be more intelligent. Then there's one that's about 7 feet tall and has very dark skin. Sometimes, though, it will be extremely pale. It's almost invariably said to be a female, and she'll generally wear a veil or a cape or a cloak, and abductees refer to her as the commander. Then we have the robots. There are two different types of robots that have been reported, and both have demonstrated an entirely mechanical type of movement. They're the metallic robots that look like chunks of metal or tin cans. And there's the fleshy robot, sometimes called an android. It either resembles humans or sometimes animals. You know, particularly unusual types of robot aliens have been seen in Prospect, Kentucky, 1977. A young man named Lee Parrish, who was 19 at the time, was driving home in his Jeep when he saw a large UFO burning brightly in a rectangular shape, hovering above the trees. The radio of his car quit, and he found his Jeep being drawn irresistibly turned to lights. Well, when he got home, he found his trip had taken him a half an hour longer than it should have, and his eyes were bloodshot and painful. So after a while, since you began to have nightmares. You underwent hypnotic regression to try and find out what had happened during that missing time. He said his Jeep had been pulled up into the air by a powerful force, and he found himself inside a circular room inside that spacecraft. He said he saw three strange creatures, one of which stood at the height of 20 feet and was shaped like a suitcase, having a raised section on top of the shape of a semicircle. It was black with one arm. Second alien was about 6 feet tall. It was red and had only one arm. Third was 6 feet tall, white with a curved profile, and had a head shaped like a wedge. Well, he sensed that the second alien was afraid of him, but it came toward him slowly and touched him with its arm. When it did so, the young man felt extremely cold, and all three of the entities faded into one another and vanished. Found himself back in his Jeep. Well, there have been a lot of stories of abductions, and there have been many, many stories of different types of creatures. I mean, look at Antonio Villabolas. The alien he met was a naked female with whom he had relations. Well, another type of entity that folks have seen might be referred to as an elemental. And under this heading, we might include a variety of sightings where the creatures resemble the fairies and elves and dwarfs and goblins that we find in folklore. One of the most striking modern cases where these type of entities were encountered is a story from Railway Regis near Birmingham in the West Midlands of England. January 1979, Jean Hingley had just said goodbye to her husband, saw him leave for work. About to go back in the house when she saw a large iron globe floating directly above the garage. Now, to her astonishment, her dog just fell over unconscious, and she saw three tiny figures come out of that iron sphere and go into her house through the front door, which was standing open. Well, they made a buzzing sound, and she rushed inside and found them in the living room. They were fascinated by the Christmas tree. Well, with presence of mind, Hingley demanded some sort of explanation from these creatures. They touched a button-type device on their tunics and mumbled gibberish back at her. So she offered them mince pie. Well, they tried to eat it, but they couldn't, and they became angry, so they zapped her with a laser beam of light from their helmets. Blinded her temporarily, burned her skin, and they picked up a number of objects, such as videotapes, and looked at them. Well, after about an hour, they left the house through the back door and went back into their spacecraft before flying off. The woman was certainly upset by her experience. She telephoned her husband and called the police. Forensic team examined the landing site and saw two parallel lines in the snow. She described her visitors as being 3.5 feet tall, without any hair on their heads, but with huge black eyes that stared at her from inside their bubble-shaped helmets. And she said they had large round wings like a butterfly. Well, it was about a week after this happened that her sight returned to normal. It took several months for the burn marks caused by the lasers to heal. And she said their radio and TV sets no longer worked, and the cassette tapes the aliens handled didn't work were inoperable. Now, years ago, well, I guess I was 15, so that'd make it over 50 years ago. We had a brand new house in an area where there had not been any houses before, but there had been a Native American village. Now, we didn't know that at the time, but one night, this greenish light came floating through the room and went down behind my TV set. Well, after that, the TV set wouldn't work. You take it out of that room, any place else in the house, it worked just fine. Put it back in that room, nothing. Never did get an answer to what that was. Certainly, it could have been an elemental. You know, another entity that's, well, it's been seen quite often in Britain. occasionally in North America, and that's the sightings of the big cats. Considerable number of the animals have been photographed. Now, maybe the most famous alien big cat is the Surrey puma and the beast of Bodmin. During the 1990s, 4 wild leopards were found dead in Britain. Over 300 sightings were reported. Sheep and calves have also been found with claw marks on them and the flesh stripped away from their bodies. A woman named Rosemary Rhodes twice videotaped a black leopard on her farm after 4 of her sheep were torn to pieces. It's been suggested by some people the animals are extraterrestrial in origin and they enter our world through space warp portals in order to prey on wildlife. Certainly anything is possible. But when searchers try to track down these creatures, they don't see any UFOs, but they don't find the animals either. And then we have the reptiles that are reptoids. These are technologically advanced extraterrestrials, described as tall, strong, having green colored or scaly skin, and faces like lizards. They're claimed, according to abductees, to be hostile, malevolent beings, and they're said to be the masters of the Greys. Now, the reptoids, according to the abductees, look on the Earth and its inhabitants as something to be exploited for their benefit. Kind of like lab rats for medical experiments, brood mares or sperm banks for their genetic program, and sometimes even as food. Well, we have also Lizard Man. It's seen in July of 83 at Mount Vernon, Missouri. It's one of the most unusual and remarkable sightings of its kind. It all began with a man named Ron Watson and his wife Paula saw flashing silver lights coming from a field. So they watched through a pair of binoculars and saw 2 figures wearing silver suits moving their hands over a black cow that lay in the field. As they started pulling their hands upward, the cow was drug up into the air as if it was being winched up by some invisible force. And as they watched, the cow floated into a nearby UFO shaped like a cone with a mirror-like surface that was so highly polished it was almost undetectable by the naked eye. As they watched, they saw 2 more aliens standing beside the UFO. One is about 6 feet high, looked like a giant lizard with green skin, large eyes, webbed hands and feet. And the other looked like a Bigfoot. Well, Ron Watson told his wife he had to get closer to see if he could have a proper look at what was going on. Wife talked him out of that, what she considered a very bad idea. Then the 3 aliens went inside the UFO, which promptly vanished. Later on, the farmer that owned that neighboring field told him one of his black cows had gone missing. They told him what they had seen, but he absolutely refused to believe it. Then there was another reptilian type of creature found mainly in the bayous and swamps of the American South. 1988, the Scape Oar monster was seen in the region of the swamp in South Carolina, from which it got its name. June of 1988, 17-year-old Christopher Davis was driving home. As he crossed the Scape Oar, his car tire blew, pulled over to the roadside to try and repair the damage. He just finished fixing the tire and was about to go home when he saw a strange 7-foot-tall creature running toward him from the field. His eyes were growing red in the darkness around him. So he jumped in the car and drove off just before the creature got to him. And he tried to get his car back on the main road as that creature pushed its hands through the window, and, which was, for some reason, still down. Davis saw 3 long fingers, green skin, and black nails. As he drove away, he said the creature chased him. Well, to his discomfort, he realized that the creature jumped on top of the roof of his car and had its long fingernails fastened to the windshield. Well, he gunned the motor and the car accelerated and the creature jumped off. Made his way home but refused to get out of the car till his father came out of the house to meet him. That shows he was a fine, upstanding young man, not afraid of much except monsters in the dark. Well, we also have giant birds. They've been seen in Salt Lake City on July of 1966. Residents saw a huge bird, described as being as big as a Piper Cub airplane, circled the city. An equally spectacular sighting took place in December of that year in Gallipolis, Ohio, where one of the four pilots who saw it said, "My God, it's something prehistoric." Well, ufologists who pride themselves on being open-minded are very closed-minded when it comes to things like this. But more and more of them are beginning to understand that the phenomenon is far wilder than simply the ubiquitous grays, and that creatures like giant birds have a part in the UFO story. Then we have the Mocha vampire, which researchers discovered in the 70s. That time, an outbreak of an inexplicable animal death hit Puerto Rico, particularly around the town of Mocha. Ducks and pigs and geese and goats were all killed, and all of them had been drained of blood. And strange lights were seen in the sky at the times these killings took place. Now, nobody ever saw the creature, and it's been suggested it was simply the same as the chupacabra, or the goat sucker that began to attack animals. Principally, but certainly nobody's exclusively goats, and drain the blood out of the bodies by making small holes in the animals, often at the back of their heads. Now, unlike the Mocha vampire, chupacabras have been seen and described as having strong hind legs, thin forearms, with sharp claws and standing about 4 feet tall. They have fangs and pointed faces and big red eyes, and according to all the stories, the activities began in 1995 at the town of Orocovis in Puerto Rico, but it soon widened to cover other areas. As with the Mochas, inhabitants also complained of seeing bright lights in the sky whenever the unexplained killings took place. Well, then we have hairy mammals. Probably the best known example of this species is Bigfoot, or Yeti. Now, the Bigfoot's a tall, completely hair-covered, extremely large ape-like creature, found principally in the Pacific Northwest region of America, and the Yeti's most commonly seen in the Himalayas. Now, another hairy mammal type that's been seen is the Yeren, principally found in the Shenongjia Mountains in the central Chinese region. It's described as being between 5 and 6 feet tall, with large feet and long, shaggy red hair. Now, sightings of these creatures go back long before UFOs were ever being discussed, which makes many ufologists deny any relation between the two. At the same time, they've been seen in the same vicinity as UFO activity, which does raise interesting questions. Then we have the Dauphinoids, aquatic aliens with the ability to communicate with humans through the use of telepathy. Unlike the Reptoids and the Greys, they tend to be benevolent beings wishing to help humanity, and they're a more contemporary version of the Space Brothers and the Space Sisters. Then we have Cyclops. August 28, 1963, Belo Horizonte, Minas Gerais, Brazil. Three boys out doing what they shouldn't have been doing came upon a terrifying entity. They were out in the back garden of their home and they saw a 10-foot-wide orb come over the house. It was a transparent globe, and the boys saw a number of aliens inside the craft, all wearing helmets and spacesuits. Two sharp, bright beams of light were then directed onto the ground by the craft, and one of the aliens floated down between those two streams of light. When the creature landed, the boys saw that it only had one eye and no body hair. It was about 10 feet tall, and it came toward them. Well, the Cyclops, as they called it, spoke to him in a language they didn't understand and made some sort of movements with his hands. The oldest of the boys picked up a rock and was getting ready to throw it at the alien when it turned to face him. On the front of his suit was a little box-like object, and the entity sent out a ray of light from it that struck the boy on the hand and forced him to drop the rock. Then the aliens tried to talk one more time before it gave up and floated back up toward the UFO, which then flew away. They went and told their parents about what had happened, and of course they weren't believed, but the father did go out into the garden and saw a number of triangular marks on the ground where the Cyclops had been walking. Well, then there are the Almas, found mainly in the Altai Mountains of Mongolia and the Tian Shan Mountains of China. They're said to be half-human, half-ape, and there are even drawings of these strange creatures that go back thousands of years. Female Alma was found in the forest of Mount Zadan in the Caucasus in the latter part of the 19th century. She became pregnant by one of the villagers and gave birth to a number of children. Now, it's been suggested the Almas represent scattered survivors of Neanderthal tribes, but it's also said they might have been the result of mating between humans and extraterrestrials. And if, in fact, the creature could mate with a human, well, who knows what it may have been. You know, there have been a number of strange appearances and disappearances. You know, cases of people disappearing into the thin air are perhaps more common than mysterious appearances out of nowhere. One of the most surprising took place in 1975 when Jackson Wright and his wife Martha were driving toward New York. As a result of snow that had formed on the windows, they stopped the car in the Lincoln Tunnel. Jackson got out to wipe the windshield, and Martha, who had gone to clean the rear windows, simply vanished. She didn't die in the tunnel, which was searched extensively, and nobody could find a clue as to what had happened to her. Now, a tunnel's hardly the most obvious or even the easiest place in which to disappear, but that's what happened. She vanished into thin air in the middle of the Lincoln Tunnel. Another baffling case is that of Armando Valdez, a corporal in the Chilean Army. 1977, in full view of six of his men, he suddenly vanished for a period of 15 minutes. On his return, his men noticed the calendar on his watch had gone forward 5 days, and he had a 5-day growth of beard on his face. Well, Valdez remembered nothing about his disappearance and couldn't give an account for what had happened to him or where he'd been for that missing period. Yet there were six witnesses to what happened. It's hard to find a rational explanation for any of these events. Circumstances of Casper Hauser's description, and I'm going to talk about Casper in a few minutes, suggests a spaceship and, of course, the truly bizarre nature of the cases of Martha Wright and Armando Valdez. It's not surprising alien abduction has been proposed as a possible explanation. Well, I mentioned Casper Hauser. It's an extremely famous and well-documented case of somebody just appearing out of nowhere. It appeared in Nuremberg in 1828. A cobbler noticed a young man staggering in his direction with a strange look on his face and could barely stand up. He held out a letter addressed to the captain of a cavalry regiment stationed in the town, and the only phrase he was able to say is, "I want to be a soldier like my father." Before long, he was taught German, and he gave his name as Casper Hauser. And he had a number of strange peculiarities, being at first able to eat and drink nothing but bread and water. Had a strong intolerance for light, which gave him a severe headache. He was almost incapable of using his hands and feet. A professor by the name of Dahmer took an interest in the young man and soon told the world about his extraordinary life before he discovered wandering the streets of Nuremberg. Casper claimed he had spent his entire life in a tiny cell where two windows were permanently blocked up and neither sound or light penetrated. His cell was maintained at a constant temperature and always lit from a power source he wasn't able to see. The only food and water he ever had was bread and water, and he had no idea of any difference between day and night. Until he got to Nuremberg, he had never seen another living person. Only once did he become aware of somebody's presence when a hand from behind him guided his own hand in tracing his name and writing the letter that he brought with him to the city. He remembered being carried out of his cell one day and led down some steps before being brought by an unknown companion into Nuremberg, where he was abandoned after boots had been put on his feet. Some time later, after he had related his strange story, there were two attempts made on his life. First attempt, he was stabbed with a knife, but the wound wasn't deep and soon healed. Later, he got a note asking him to meet somebody in the park. Soon after his arrival, he came home in a state of collapse with clear signs of a stab wound in his chest. And he said both stabbings were the work of the same man, the one he first brought him to Nuremberg, and shortly after that he died. Well, there are a number of features about the Kaspar Hauser story that make it quite possible he was an alien who had landed on Earth from a spaceship. His physical difficulties in walking, his intolerance to sunlight, and the fact he had a lump at the back of his knee instead of the normal hollow. All hint at some generally strange experience lying behind his story. And in 1828, there was absolutely no way of keeping a room at an even temperature or maintaining a light burning day and night. But on board a spacecraft, that could have happened. And in Chatham, in Kent, in 1914, shoppers were stunned to see a naked man suddenly appear in front of them. And after a few moments, he was gone. No explanation was ever forthcoming. And then there's the Children of Woolpit. Now, throughout history, there have been a number of cases involving people who have literally appeared out of nowhere, and even more where they have abruptly and mysteriously disappeared. Well, the story of the Children of Woolpit go back to the 11th century, and is certainly baffling. Seems as if the children emerged from a crater in the earth. They didn't speak English. They were green skin in color. The girl was about 12, and her brother seemed to be a little younger. Beans were the only item of food they appeared to be able to eat. Now, after a period of adjustment, they were taught English and told their host they came from a place called St. Martin's. Had no idea how they appeared suddenly in Woolpit. And as they got accustomed to their new home, they lost their green color and took on an ordinary human appearance. Now, the boy died young, but the girl went on to become a domestic servant before ending her days married to a man from King's Lynn in Norfolk. Certainly, that genealogy would be interesting to be able to trace. Now, you know, there are thousands and thousands of stories of contact with aliens. But let's talk about the first alien kidnap victims. Now, the first abductions appeared to have happened in 1953, but wasn't reported till 1975. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, March 22nd, 1953. Sarah Shaw and Jan Whitley, 21 and 22, respectively, saw a bright light come over their house in a regular manner. Shaw glazed out the window to get a better look, immediately felt giddy, checked her watch, and saw it was 4 o'clock in the morning. They had lost 2 hours. Well, it wasn't until 1975 that she underwent sessions of hypnosis that she recalled in a state of trance how both she and Whitley had been taken aboard a UFO. She said both girls were stripped naked and examined by aliens dressed in black. And they told Shaw at the time, she said, that vinegar could cure cancer. Well, Shaw admitted she found the attention she got from the male aliens pleasurable. Girls then floated back home where they, just as they had floated up to the ship on a beam of light. And once they got back in the house, they immediately lost any memory of what had happened. Now, it's worth pointing out, although Shaw had called UFO researcher Ann Druffel 20 years after the original experience, and Druffel recommended she undergo a course of hypnotic memory regression, the story she told was also confirmed in all essential details by Whitley. Like Shaw, she remembered being abducted by aliens and the sexual attention they focused on the two young women. And she said in 1956, she began to experience recurring nightmares focusing on alien abduction. In addition, Whitney revealed she'd also experienced an abduction scenario of her own. This time it didn't involve Shaw, but another young female named Emily Coronin. 1956, both girls were driving home, and immediately after they pulled up to a rest stop, they saw a bright light. They said it was yellowish white. Immediately, both girls became paralyzed, and Cronin saw a man watching them through the rear window of a car. And with tremendous effort, Whitney managed to move one finger, after which the effect of the paralysis stopped. Whitney also claimed in 67 and 68, she woke up and found herself unable to move a muscle and saw ugly little faces hovering in the room above her head. Not surprisingly, it's been suggested Shaw's abduction testimony, especially the part where she describes her enjoyment of the attention she got from the male humanoids, was expressing an inner dissatisfaction with the lesbian relationship in which she was involved with Whitney at the time. Now, certainly it's a possibility, particularly as her memory wasn't recovered until over 20 years had passed. The mere fact that Whitley entirely independently gave the same account of the experience as Shaw, and she'd also undergone similar phenomena, both on her own and with Cronin, strongly suggests that three women are telling the truth. Of course, one of the most famous stories is that of Antonio Villa-Boas, as I talked about earlier. Now, another abductee, contactee, is Krista Tilton. I got the opportunity to meet her a number of years ago. She claims a long history of alien abduction dating back to when she was 10 years old. She was visiting her aunt in Tucson at the time and witnessed a huge ball of orange fire falling to the ground. Short time afterwards, she saw small gray aliens and two of them bizarrely exchanged rocks. She blacked out and woke up to find herself on a table with a man standing over who told her to call him the doctor. Once on board the spacecraft, she is subjected to a series of medical procedures, including having scrapings taken of her skin. She used a device to examine inside her abdomen. She was conscious of a sharp object entering her ear. Now, this was her description of her first abduction. She said quite a number followed. During one of them, she became pregnant by the aliens, but in 71, while she was in New Orleans, her fetus was removed during another abduction. Now, the most remarkable of her abduction experiences, which otherwise were fairly similar to those of other experiences, took place in July of 87. She drove into the desert and saw a spaceship parked on top of a hill. There were two aliens standing beside it, waiting for her to arrive, apparently. And although she locked the car door, somehow they managed to open them. And in spite of her attempts to struggle against her captors, they subdued her and took her back to their spaceship. They gave her a drink, and she remembered nothing more till she was led out of the vehicle and apparently was parked inside a cave. She said she was taken to an underground base that she claims is in the Dulce area of New Mexico. They took her inside and made her undergo an extremely long and tough security check before leading her through a number of separate levels, at each of which she had to undergo another security check. As seemed to be normal with her abduction experiences, she was subjected to another set of medical tests. Then they took her up to what she described as level 6. Then, at that point, her guards informed her she wouldn't be able to enter that particular part of the facility. So they took her back to level 1 and let her go. Inside the underground base, she saw a man dressed in a red military-style jumpsuit, wore some type of patch, and carried an automatic weapon. Inside the facility, she saw huge tanks with computerized gauges hooked to them and huge arm-like device that extended from the top of some tubing down into the tanks. She said the tanks were about 4 feet high, and she believes the underground base is connected with the military in some way. She said the tanks were used as artificial wombs for genetic experiments on human-alien hybrids, and they smell strongly of formaldehyde. Soon as they took her back to her car, she drove to her aunt's house and went into a sound, dreamless sleep. Next day, her friend saw some red scratches on her back that she claimed to have incurred when she fought with her alien abductors. She wrote in a book giving more detail about the mysterious underground facility she encountered in the course of her 87 abduction. Some of the stories she told when I had the opportunity to talk to her were absolutely fascinating. There's quite a lot of information in various locations about aliens and ghost rockets and things like that. But one thing that fascinates me is the moon. You know, it's always been a source of mystery and magic. And it's said to have many secrets, some of which remain unsolved to this day. And one of the most baffling is its influence on the tides and the growth of crops and the menstrual cycles of women. Now, by all rational calculations, the moon's distance from the Earth should be too great for the lunar gravitational pull to override the Earth's gravity. But its influence on such things is a matter beyond dispute, though how it does it is a major mystery. Now, science has long told us the moon is barren, lifeless, and inhospitable. They said it was a planet formed when it spun off from Earth, going into an orbit of its own, partly circling Earth and partly orbiting around the sun. Now, these claims have been made since the 17th century. But since the lunar expeditions have become more and more difficult to maintain. Though there is fierce controversy over the possibility of life, past or present, on the moon, there seems overwhelming evidence that the moon is not, and never was, a body that spun off from the Earth. In fact, it's increasingly doubtful if it was even a body formed within the solar system at all. Even on inert matter, the moon plays a part. Silver chloride, for instance, crystallized by lunar influence. Radio reception can be affected by lunar interference, while the effect of the moon, especially the full moon, on human behavior is well known. In fact, if you'll remember, the word lunatic comes from the Latin term for the moon. So how's that possible given the relative distance of the two planets and the weakness of the gravitational pull of the moon? Then there's the question of how old is the moon? Helena Blavatsky claimed in 1888 the moon was older than the Earth. She said, "The lords of the moon, our ancestors, pioneered and developed our planet." And the curious thing is that NASA missions actually give support to her claim based solely on messages she claimed to receive from elementary masters dwelling in Tibet that the moon is older than the Earth. Well, some of the rocks that were brought back when examined proved to be a billion years older than the age of the Earth. Now, equally controversial is the glacial cosmology put forward by the Austrian astronomer Hans Horbiger. Because of the personal belief in his story by both Hitler and Himmler, it became highly influential during the period of Nazi rule. In essence, he claimed the birth of worlds and the universe came about as a result of a constant struggle between the elements of fire and ice. The moon itself was a solid block of frozen ice. Now, all the claims by Harbinger have long since been refuted. The moon is not made out of ice anymore, it's made out of green cheese. Origins of the universe weren't the result of a cosmic battle between ice and fire. And there is, however, one surprising exception. There was a solitary grain of possible truth within his otherwise eccentric cosmology. It has been discovered that, in fact, there is water on the moon. In fact, water vapor has been seen coming from several of the craters. You know, the most interesting aspect of Horbiger's cosmology, and the only one that seems to have gained in plausibility since NASA went to the moon, is his claim the moon is not a body formed out of Earth, but a planet that strayed into the solar system from outside and became trapped by the gravitational pull of the Earth. This notion is known as the capture theory. Now, in its simplest form, the capture hypothesis has gained ground steadily since the 1970s. And he also claimed the moon that shines in our skies at present is not the only satellite to have circled the Earth. He says there was a whole series of lunar bodies, each in turn having first approached too closely and then become trapped by the gravity. Now, there's no geological or archaeological evidence in support of his theory of more than one moon. But there is a considerable body of testimony in the form of myths and legends that speak of a time when there was no moon at all in the sky. There are also myths and legends of capture, collapse, and there having been successive moons. There's additionally a very small amount of astronomical evidence in its favor, though it's always been hotly disputed. Certainly, the calendar found at Tiwanaku appears to refer to a time when the orbit of the moon around the Earth was entirely different from how it orbits now. Now, what is beyond question is that NASA's expeditions have tended to confirm Horbinger's claim that the moon is not native to our solar system. And I made reference to the fact that rock samples taken from the moon are older than the oldest rocks on Earth. And this hardly makes sense if the moon is the same age as our planet. And although the figures have been fought over for decades, some lunar rocks appear to be older than the solar system. Now, this is quite inconceivable on the orthodox spinoff hypothesis, although it presents no problem at all if the capture theory is true. Well, when we went to the moon, NASA, the civilian space agency, as it's touted, was in charge of the mission. But very few people realize that NASA is part of the Department of Defense. And anything that would tend to confirm the existence of aliens is by definition automatically classified at the highest level. If you reveal something that tends to prove that there are aliens or anything along those lines, you can be arrested. And certainly that threat is a real one. Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow night and talk more about mysteries of the moon. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.